The views expressed on the Buckmaster Radio program are not necessarily the views of Bill Buckmaster Communications, LLC, or its sponsors.
Hello, everybody. Bill Buckmaster along with my friend Ray Allen. It's good to have Ray on the other side of the glass. For years, we were partners, and now Ray's back a couple of days a week, at least for the time being, with us on Buckmaster, where he is engineering and producing. And we welcome you to the program on this Thursday, October 31st, Halloween 2019. We'll talk more about Halloween with our faith and spirituality contributor, Father Robert. He'll be joining us in about 15 minutes. Lots to talk about in that area. We're broadcasting from the Green Things Zocalo Village Studio. You're listening to 1030 Tucson's Voice for Trust and News Talk, worldwide live listening on my website, buckmastershow.com, making it very easy for you. All of our programs live streamed, and then we get them up, thanks to my assistant, Rosemary Brandt, get them posted probably 2 to 3 hours at the conclusion of the program. They're available at buckmastershow.com. Next Tuesday night, when all of the votes are in, Lane Santa Cruz, Democrat, hopes to be the new Ward 1 City of Tucson Council member. Lane Santa Cruz with us now on the Buckmaster Show live line. Lane, how are you?
I'm doing really well, Bill. Thanks for asking.
Well, how's the campaign gone? Has it lived up to your expectations?
Well, let me just say the primaries were so intense that I felt like every hour of every day, made a difference when it came talking to voters, that in the general election, when you're running citywide, there's only so much ground that you can cover. So it's definitely kind of doing a different strategy, when you're running citywide. But I'm looking forward to getting to work on the job that we're running for, because the work of running for office is so different than, actually serving in the seat.
If you emerge victorious Tuesday, what will a Lane Santa Cruz council person, what are you going to bring to the office? Let's put it that way.
All right. Yeah, for sure. So I think we have such an amazing opportunity in the city, because the council offices are actually rooted in the communities and the districts that they're serving. So I really want that they to feel welcoming, and that it belongs to the community as a community center where folks can have activities and meetings and other things happening there as they're coming in and also to learn about what's happening in the city. I think we need to do a better job of educating the public on the policy issues or the budget and those types of things in the city in a way that's accessible and transparent to the public. So that's something that I want to do. I also see my role more as a facilitator because I'm really interested in how we co-govern with our community, with our public, where it's not about me and my voice. It's a collective of voices, and I'm helping facilitate that at City Hall.
Your friend, Rahina Romero, you served with Rahina. You were in the Ward 1 office for a while. I forget how many years. What was that, a couple of years?
It was 4 years total.
Yeah. Okay, 4 years. So Rahina says she is, quote, vehemently opposed to the sanctuary city measure. Does your level of opposition to it reach that level?
Bill, so actually I have said that I support the initiative because I support cities coming together and putting things on the ballot that's apparent to them. And I know that, police accountability is one of the ways, that we can make sure that we're protecting our most vulnerable. But there's still a whole list of things that we have to do if we're to actually be a safer space, for vulnerable communities here in the city of Tucson.
So I do stand corrected. So I was of the understanding that really none of the candidates running for city office were in favor of 205, but you are on record, you are backing 205.
I support it and I voted for it.
Okay. What has been the emerging issue when you go door to door? And I know as a ward candidate, you do a lot of knocking on doors and appearing at events. What do you think the people are saying? Is it about economic issues? Is that the number one issue?
I think the two biggest things that I heard at the door was people's neighborhood street. They really want those. They want those fixed. They feel like they've lived their whole lives and that kind of investment hasn't been there. there. And then the other big thing people are concerned about their schools, about education, and how do we make sure that like their children, their grandchildren, you know, have the support that they need. Because I think a lot of our families still see like schools as what's going to like bring better economic future for families. And if they feel like if that's lacking for them, then that future of being able to live like, you know, like just having that economic stability, then that's up in the air. So those were two of the big things that I heard at the doors. And then, you know, of course, the third one was always like wanting to make sure that they have a council member that's accessible.
All right, Lane Santa Cruz, and the votes, people had to turn in their or mail in their ballots yesterday, but there is still another avenue, right, that folks can use.
Yes.
Why don't you explain that to us real quickly?
Yes. Yeah, so you can drop it off at the Sun City Clerk's office over off of Park and Broadway. They're open from 8 to 5 Monday through Friday. And I believe this coming Saturday, they'll be open as well from like 8 to noon. If you want to drop it off person and just feel like I want to make sure this gets to the right hands. And then on election day, you know, we'll have a number of neighborhood centers around the city that will be taking ballots. And like in Ward 1, the closest one, Ward 1, are going to be the El Pueblo Neighborhood Center, the Senior Center over off Irvington, and then also the Housing and Community Development building over on Bonita, just west of the freeway.
Okay, Lane Santa Cruz, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bill. Have a good one.
Thanks a lot. Lane Santa Cruz, Ward 1 City Council Democrat, hopes to emerge victorious when all the votes are in, and that will be, they usually conclude about 8 o'clock, might be a safe guess, somewhere around there on Tuesday evening. This portion of the Buckmaster Show presented by our friends over in Silver City and Grant County, New Mexico. It's only a 3-hour drive, and it is a very pretty area of the land of enchantment, that southwest corner. And it's really this time of year, how do you beat it when you have that kind of mile high elevation? Think of Denver around 5,000 to 6,000 feet. Well, that's the elevation over in Silver City. I would suggest southwestnewmexico.org, a great starting place for things to do, and there are all sorts of activities, hiking the Gila National Wilderness, and great places to stay. southwestnewmexico.org. We'll talk about Halloween on Buckmaster in the Green Things Zocalo Village Studios next. Family-owned Jam Culinary Concepts and its family of restaurants has you covered for your special event. Jam caters anytime, anywhere, any size group, and any type of cuisine. Vero Amore, authentic Neapolitan pizza, and Noble Hops. Craft beer and fine fare are synonymous with quality. Call 954-1468 or log on to jamculinaryconcepts.com. Cushman & Wakefield Picor is Tucson's leading independently owned full-service commercial real estate company. Founded in 1985, Cushman & Wakefield Picor offers leasing, sales, and property management for industrial, office, medical, retail, land, and investment properties in Tucson and Sonora, Mexico. Visit our website at picor.com for the latest news from Tucson's commercial real estate sector. That's picor.com. Call us at 748-7100. The regional Transportation Authority has a 35-member Citizens Advisory Committee working to identify transportation priorities for the region and will be seeking public input on those priorities before too long. These priorities will help guide development of an RTA continuation plan. The current RTA plan and half-cent excise tax will continue through June 2026. To sign up for RTA updates, visit rtamobility.com. This is Bill Buckley. Buckmaster encouraging you to fly from Tucson International Airport. When you fly Tucson, you're standing up for Tucson. A new study shows the Tucson Airport Authority's annual economic impact is $7.4 billion, with almost $1 billion of that from visitors flying into the airport. Fly Tucson, and airlines will respond with more flights, bringing more visitors, benefiting all of us. Type in TUS when you book your next flight and fly Tucson.
This is Moa Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing.
And this is Bill Buckmaster. For several decades now, Moe has been my go-to expert for all my framing needs and bathroom mirrors. I trust Moe for service, professionalism, and top-of-the-line quality.
Thanks, Bill. Give us a call at 795-8226 and stop by Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing on the southwest corner of Fort Lowell and Dodge. right next to Copenhagen, and on the web at mosgallery.com.
Green Things is a family-owned and operated plant nursery serving Tucson since 1970. Open daily at 3384 East River Road, Green Things is chock full of plants and pottery from around the world. Green Things is also now home to Zocalo, featuring fine Mexican and South American imports spread over five buildings on the 13-acre Green Things property. For more, visit greenthingsaz.com and zocalovillage.com.
Are you happy with the news you get? While not all news is good news, you know good reporting when you see it. Check TucsonSentinel.com every day for breaking news and investigative reports. Have your say in the comments. It's all in TucsonSentinel.com, your local, independent, nonprofit news. You can rely on TucsonSentinel.com for solid reporting about immigration, Tucson and Pima politics, everything from the border to baseball. It's independent news without the spin. TucsonSentinel.com. We are watching Tucson.
Welcome back. It is the Buckmaster Show. Halloween, celebrated every October 31st by millions of people throughout the world. It's a fun holiday, especially for the kids with their costumes, candies, parties. But many people would like to know its origin. Quite often in the question of faith, the question is whether Halloween is secular, Christian, or pagan. Joining me in studio on the Buckmaster Show, the Buckmaster contributor on faith and spirituality, Father Robert Hendrickson, the parish priest at St. Philip's in the Hills Episcopal Church, which is my place of worship. Father Robert, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Doing very well. And I noticed you did not say Happy Halloween. And there, I'm kind of happy about that because I know it's the standard greeting on this day, but it's kind of contrary. Actually, Father Robert, if the day was really horrifying, I guess we'd be celebrating it, or we wouldn't be celebrating it for sure. Maybe it's more a day to make light of supernatural evil than to be frightened by it.
Well, absolutely. And this comes up in the church periodically. So, for example, when Lent rolls around, it's very hard to sort of say, well, I hope you have a happy Lent, or whatever. It just doesn't quite work. Yeah. But, you know, the thing with Halloween is it's such an interesting day because it really is rooted in the kind of defiance of these things that we think are so overwhelming, the forces of death and evil and this. And for most faith traditions, and for certainly the Christian tradition, our proclamation is that those things have no power over us. And so I think that's part of what Halloween is. Halloween's complicated because when, you know, you asked, is it pagan, is it religious, yeah, is it secular? And the answer is D, all of the above. Mm-hmm. And so it's an interesting and uniquely American sort of phenomenon in a lot of ways.
I like that, what you just said, that it is a mixture of all of those. Some would be inclined to take the straightforward answer that definitely Halloween is secular. No, you've got to really look at this really long history that some would say go back to Roman Celtic times.
Sure. There are really three strains, all of which come together in the unique immigrant experience of the United States. So there's the sort of Celtic Roman strain, and that's probably the one where the engagement with sort of the lost souls comes from. Because in that tradition, there was already All Saints Day, which celebrated saints who had gone into heaven. There was All Souls Day, which remembered souls who were in purgatory, and you prayed for them and made different kinds of offerings to help get them out of purgatory. But then there was another day that developed primarily in Celtic tradition that was actually called the All Damned Day. And it was for those souls who were in hell. And the idea was that you would go around banging pots and pans to let them know that you were remembering them too, because you didn't want them to get too upset and to come out and sort of cause mischief. And so that was a kind of uniquely Celtic take. And then in France around 14th, 15th century, there were these very elaborate dances that developed and that were full of costumes and pageantry and had the devil leading various people dressed in various ways to hell and to other sorts of temptations. And so that's probably where the costumes come from. And then there's also perhaps the British influence. Guy Fawkes Day was, for those of you who know the history there, there was a failed plot to overthrow the king, the gunpowder plot. And for some years after there, young kids would go around to the households of Catholics and bang on the doors and ask for baked goods or things like this. And that was trick or treat, right?
Yeah.
And so what happens in the U.S. is you have the French Catholics sort of living side by side with Irish Catholics, living side by side with British Protestants, and all these things sort of blend together in that sort of wonderful American way. So it does become religious and secular and pagan influences in other ways. And so it's one of those holidays that I think we can celebrate with a good deal of enthusiasm, because I think it marks the intersection of the religious and the secular. It marks the recognition that that all of what we consider to be sort of the metaphysical or the spiritual world is actually all around us at the same time, in a way that I think Americans sort of lose sight of. And so it's a kind of celebration of a whole lot of things coming together. And ultimately, it's a celebration of the fact that these things that can be so frightening are actually things we can make light of in light of our hope.
So did Halloween evolve out of the Catholic holiday called All Hallows' Eve?
Yes. So All Saints' Day, which is tomorrow. So in church tradition, the evening of the day before actually begins the day. So, for example, this evening will begin All Saints' Day. So it's All Hallows' Eve, hallow meaning blessed. Mm-hmm. So it's the evening of the Feast of the Blessed One, sort of All Saints' Day. And then the next day is All Souls' Day on Saturday. And so many churches, so for example, we have a really robust All Souls' Day celebration. We have a robust All Saints' Day celebration. And so it kind of begins 3 days. And if you'll remember, in Easter, there are 3 days that mark Easter. So you have Maundy, Thursday, Good Friday, and Easter. And this was considered the sort of fall companion to that. So you had All Hallows Eve, All Saints Day, and then All Souls Day. And so it was the mirror image of that with the spring festival being one celebrating life and the fall festival being one where we recognize the reality of death.
A trinity, in effect.
Mm-hmm, yeah, sort of. They called them the Triduum, 3 days. So this was called the All Death Triduum. So it's a kind of an interesting, you don't see that card in the Hallmark store very often.
No, you don't. So Pope Gregory III, we've got to go back to the 8th century.
I'm going back to seminary here. Let's
go. There you go. He was the Pope, 731 to 741 AD. And he's commonly credited with moving the holiday of to November the 1st of All Saints' Day, which was originally celebrated on May the 13th.
Yes. Yeah, so they were sort of, they moved it to, like so many holidays, they moved it to correspond with a celebration that was happening in Rome. And so a lot of the holidays were moved around to more accord with the Roman calendar in the Roman church in Italy. And all these things sort of begin to come together and begin to coalesce around a response to the Black Death. And so as the whole of Europe is facing the reality of 30, 40, 50, 60% of some areas being decimated, I think they were looking to the church and looking to around them and saying, how do we respond to this? How do we make any sense of this at all? And so I think part of what emerged was this very natural response from the church and from society, from the culture, to make light of it, but B, recognize that those who were lost were not lost forever, mm-hmm. and that you might still communicate with them, pray for them, and have them pray for you. And I think all that came together in that kind of pastoral response that happened organically in the life of the church and the communities that were affected.
There was a wonderful movie recently out called Coco, which talked about the tradition in Mexico of All Saints Day and All Souls Day. And All Souls Day is... people here in Tucson have really gone all in on it. There may be 150,000 people in downtown Tucson taking part this Sunday in the All Souls Day celebration.
Yeah, and I think that it's, we talk now about how, Europe is post-Christian and the United States is trending that way. But I don't think it means we're post-belief. I think many of us are longing for that sense that we're still connected in some way or another to people we don't see, to things we don't see. And I think this response to All Souls Day is a perfect example. And one of the beautiful customs I like about All Souls Day is there's a custom of children going out and cleaning the gravestones of those that they lost, loved ones from their family that they had lost. I think it's one of those beautiful examples of the future meeting the past together in a very tangible way.
We don't do death very well in this society.
We do it terribly, actually. it would not do it well would be an understatement. I was having a conversation with my mother-in-law, and we were talking about sort of planning for the future, and my wife was very exasperated, and she said, well, Mom, if I died tomorrow, if I got hit by a bus tomorrow, wouldn't you want to know what my last wishes were? And her mother said, well, honey, your last wish would be that you didn't get hit by a bus. Right. So that was her way of sort of, you know, denying the simple act of just planning for what would happen in the future. We're on Saturday, we're doing an All Souls Day retreat where we're helping people engage end of life planning and afterlife planning. And we have about 50 people sign up, which is a nice response. So I hope that people are getting not just more realistic about death, but also more hopeful about it, because I think that once you decide how you want to die, you'll decide how you want to live. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the hardest lesson that we're not learning right now, is we're spending so much time defying death that we're actually defying life at the same time.
What can we learn from the Middle Ages when it comes to death?
I think what we can learn is that...
Didn't you write some essay about that?
I did. A couple of years ago, I wrote what the modern church can learn from the medieval church. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things that I experience in when you read the writings of medieval theologians and writers is that they have this pragmatism about the end of life that is bound up with their hope for the next life. And so I think there's a view that life is changed and not ended in death, and that you can, by facing death head on, you begin to face your life more in a more clear-eyed way. And when you think about, you know, life expectancies at that time were quite different and much shorter. And so the reality was much more imminent for many people. And especially when you recognize that, combine that with the reality of what was happening with the bubonic plague, there's just this embrace of death as not something to be feared, but as something that was just going to happen. And when it did happen, it was not to be marked with a profound lack of hope, but with a profound sense that those who were going before us were preparing a way for us to follow.
It's interesting about spirituality. A recent poll shows that 45% of Americans believe in ghosts.
Yes, I think, you know, it is amazing to me, you know, for all the talk about sort of being a, you know, post-religious or post-Christian society, people believe in a whole range of things, and I think that it has to do with our recognition that there are so many things beyond our senses, and so many things beyond sort of what I would call the sort of mere cognition that we all recognize day to day. And I think that we're trying to figure out and sort through those things by engaging things like, things like questions around ghosts and mm-hmm. questions around sort of crystals and meditation and all these sorts of things that I think are all just a deeper recognition that everything we need is not within ourselves, that there's a reality around us that we're trying to tap into, a reality that we often can't see. And we get sparks of it. We get sort of glimpses of it. And I think all those practices are ways to try and expand those sparks into some kind of fire, something that lights us up in a way that we feel like maybe is missing from time to time.
With your kids, and I've enjoyed looking at the costumes with your own kids, the kids just love Halloween. What is it about Halloween? Is it the anticipation of the sweet stuff, or it's the dressing up, kind of being something in a fantasy world? Is that kind of the motivator?
Well, for ours, my wife and I were laughing. We have had like 5 or 6 bags of candy sitting out in the house. The kids haven't touched it the whole week. It's just been sitting there. They haven't touched it. So it's not the candy they're excited about. I think it is the dressing up. It's the ability to try on a different identity. It's the ability to kind of go out into the world as something different. My son this morning went out as Harry Potter. That was super exciting to him. My other son went out as a monkey, which was also very exciting to him. You know, so there's something about that ability to try things on. And I think adults could learn from that. I think we could learn to try things on now and then in a way we forget how to do at some point or another, probably when we start getting mortgages.
Yeah, there you go. The remaining few seconds, you do have a very busy, active weekend. Why don't you give us a little hint of what's going on at St. Philip's
sure.
in the Hills?
We have a All Souls Day retreat from 1 to 6 o'clock on Saturday about preparing for end of life. We have a huge All Souls service on Saturday night at 7 p.m. where we'll have the Duraflay Requiem, which is one of the most beautiful pieces of music in history. And then Sunday morning, we celebrate the Feast of All Saints, with the music of John Rutter, one of the most glorious pieces, the Gloria and Psalm 150 set in a way that would make you think you're in a 1950s Western or sci-fi film. It's pretty glorious.
Very nice. Father Robert Hendrickson, thank you very much, from St. Philip's in the Hills, the contributor on faith and spirituality on the Buckmaster Show. I'm so pleased to have Father Robert and two dozen or so contributors, people who are very passionate about what they do, and it's a pleasure for those people to share their work and passion on our program. Thank you, Father Robert.
Thank you, as always.
All right, Buckmaster, midway point of the program on 1030 The Voice, trusted news talk in the Green Things Zocalo Village studio. Be right back.
CBS News update. The House is moving ahead with the impeachment inquiry after holding a vote to make it official today. Rules Committee Chairman Jim McGovern called it an important moment.
I do not take any pleasure in the need for this resolution. We are not here in some partisan exercise. We are here because the facts compel us to be here.
Republicans say Democrats are abusing their power. Georgia's Doug Collins.
We are so hurried to impeach this president, we don't really give a darn about the rules.
The House is on the road to impeaching President Trump, but political analyst Larry Sabato says the Senate will not vote to remove him after trial.
It's an impossibility. It will not happen. 20 Republicans would have to defect. They're all afraid of President Trump, even the ones who are retired.
CBS News has confirmed that Army Lieutenant Colonel Alex Vindman, the top Ukraine expert at the White House, has agreed to testify in public if needed. CBS News update, I'm Pam Coulter.
Noble Hops is Tucson's original gastro pub, serving an impressive menu of craft beer and fine fare. Choose from more than 175 beers from around the world, plus wine in a full bar. Enjoy delicious soups, salads, burgers, sandwiches, hearty entrees, and more. Craft beer, fine fair, great service, and stunning views. Noble Hops, perfect for lunch, dinner, happy hour, late night, and any time in between. Open daily at La Cunada and Lambert Lane in Oro Valley. Cushman & Wakefield Picor is Tucson's leading independently owned full-service commercial real estate company. Founded in 1985, Cushman & Wakefield Picor offers leasing, sales, and property management for industrial, office, medical, retail, land, and investment properties in Tucson and Sonora, Mexico. Visit our website at picor.com for the latest news from Tucson's commercial real estate sector. That's picor.com. Call us at 748-7100.
The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun cover two of Arizona's most desirable communities. The newspapers reach more than 75% of the communities each week, with a combined population of more than 50,000. The Green Valley News also publishes a dozen magazines each year, and both newspapers publish up-to-the-minute local news online at gvnews.com. The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun, it's all right here.
Ever dream of taking a river cruise? Bon Voyage Travel introduces you to Ama Waterways. You'll explore authentic culture in captivating landscapes in luxury and comfort, all on board an award-winning fleet, while you travel through incredible cities and villages in Europe, Southeast Asia, and Africa. Picture yourself on the river, indulging in Ama Waterways' locally inspired cuisine paired with complimentary wine with every lunch and dinner. Contact Bon Voyage Travel today to customize your river cruise vacation.
As a small business owner, I appreciate the services of a top-notch certified public accountant. That's why Michael C. Flowers of Flowers, Rieger & Associates is the CPA firm of the Buckmaster Show. Michael's a former Small Business Leader of the Year in Tucson. He'll professionally handle all of your accounting needs and tax preparation services. Flowers, Rieger & Associates, 6125 East Grant Road, and on the web, flowersrieger.com.
The average person in the USA today takes over 12 prescription medicines each year, and if you are over age 65, it is more than 17 medicines. CredibleMeds.org is a nonprofit organization dedicated to helping inform you and your healthcare providers. Over 30,000 people die each year from reactions to their medicines. Don't be one of those numbers. Be informed and stay safe. Visit CredibleMeds.org today and take control of your healthcare
by taking your medicines safely.
Vets working hard to save wildlife covered in cactus spines. A skunk left for dead, miraculously saved by a caring citizen. Those are just a couple of the headlines from the nonprofit Tucson Animal Rescue Center, where thousands of animals are cared for each year at its state-of-the-art Far East Side Tucson facility. Rescue, rehab, and release. The Tucson Wildlife Center, saving wildlife for more than two decades. Donate online at TucsonWildlife.com or call 290-WILD.
Welcome back. It is the Buckmaster Show. We're in the Green Things Zocalo Village studio. I love green things. First of all, I love green things. And then I love things that are beautiful that you can put into the garden. Well, they've got you covered over at Green Things, 3384 East River Road by the Rito River, just west of the Brandy Fenton Park. And we don't talk about their staff enough. These are such knowledgeable people in the nursery business over there. They can tell you, I mean, the variety of plants alone, how they know all of those plants is just amazing to me. On the 13-acre site, beside the green things, is Zocalo. All that great merchandise, much of it beautifully hand-carved from Mexico, Ecuador, Peru. There's some European items. So they're like five shops in what Jan and Jack, the owners, have created. Now they've got Zocalo Village. So bottom line, it's a destination in itself. GreenThingsAZ.com or ZocaloVillage.com. Arizona and 12 other states recently legalized the growing of hemp. It is mainly being used to produce something called CBD, which some folks claim can soothe various ailments. We're going to talk about that right off bat with Dr. Jeff Silvertooth, the Buckmaster contributor on agriculture. Professor Silvertooth has been with the University of Arizona College of Agriculture and Life Sciences since 1987. He's currently the Associate Dean and Director for Extension and Economic Development, where he provides overall leadership and administrative and personnel management for the Arizona Cooperative Extension. He also serves as the Associate Director for the Arizona Experimental Station. Did I get all that right, Jeff?
Yes, you did.
I got all of your very impressive titles. I'm going to let you pronounce CBD. Stands for hemp-based
cannabinoid derivatives. Yeah.
There you go. Yeah. There you go. Well, this has just taken off. New York Times recently had a piece saying that some farmers, and they were talking to farmers in Illinois, Jeff,
right.
who said this has been like a lifesaver to them economically.
Right. Well, you know, it's a good example, Bill, of our capacity to grow a lot of different crops in Arizona and a lot of other places as well, but we certainly can in Arizona. But the key always is the market.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's so people ask, why don't you grow this? Why don't you grow that in terms of various crop selections? And many times we could. We could find a location in Arizona in a season that would fit a lot of cropping systems. But it's always the dependence on a market that's key.
We have to go back to the farm bill for opening the door, the avenue for this cultivation, correct?
Yes, sir. Right.
Tell me about that.
Well, that's been going on. There's been a push for quite some time to add a crop like this. Primarily, you mentioned the CBD products that are being being taken out of the hemp plant production. But the real driving force has often been not only for the oils from which CBD is derived from, extracted from, but also for the fibers. And the fibers that this plant produces are advantageous for a lot of different purposes industrially. And so there's been an interest in developing the markets for those demands for these types of fibers. The problem, of course, has been is that hemp is Cannabis sativa. That's genus and species of the same plants that are used for recreational or medicinal marijuana. It's just a different strain or different set of varieties, a set of different selections genetically. So the concerns have always been with regard to regulation.
Hemp was grown in American fields, Jeff, as you know, until the 1930s when it was included in federal legislation restricting marijuana. Even then, it was not eradicated. Wild hemp is often called ditch weed.
Exactly.
Yeah, ditch weed.
Where I grew up, that's what ditch weed was.
In Oklahoma, where you grew up, they called it ditch weed. So it was everywhere, huh?
It was all over the place. But, you know, I didn't know, but people told me that it wasn't very potent with regard to, you know, medicinal or recreational marijuana effects. But yeah, you can see that you could find the plants in the ditches, literally in the bar ditches and the sides of fields when I was working on farms in southern Kansas and Oklahoma. It was commonly have one of the weeds that was growing in the ditch or in the fence lines.
One of your colleagues in the business was quoted in this New York Times piece, Tyler Mark. He's an agriculture agricultural economist at the University of Kentucky, and he's a specialist in hemp. He says it went from a trickle to a flood. What are we seeing in Arizona?
It's ramping up quickly. The 2018 Farm Bill provided a provision where each state could then take on the authorization, which had to be submitted through an application to the USDA. And the USDA, if they granted that to the, like in our case, most states, it's the Department of Agriculture that's been making those submissions for application for regulation. And they were given the approval then from the USDA, which we received in Arizona, I believe it was about June, July. And following that, then the State Department of Agriculture, or Arizona Department of Agriculture, ADA, we call it, they began to develop the licensing process for anybody in Arizona if you wanted to produce commercial industrial hemp. And so, for example, we have, you mentioned my responsibilities with the Arizona Experiment Station.
That's up in We have
the Maricopa Agricultural Center, which is our largest 2,100-acre facility.
2,100 acres?
2,100 acres is huge for an experiment station. But it's northwest of Pinal, northwest of Casa Grande, about 25 miles in Pinal County, close to the town of Maricopa.
Okay.
We have another large facility in Yuma, both in the Mesa and the Valley.
Mm-hmm.
At Safford Agricultural Center, we have Tucson Area Ag Centers.
Mm-hmm.
This has kind of an array of locations right around Pima County. Then we also have the V-Bar V Ranch, which is a large ranching operation in northern Arizona. But what we're doing right now is we have authorization because we've secured a license from the state through that process to be able to plant hemp for field research purposes on those experiment stations.
Really?
And so we're just getting started at that right now. But there's a huge interest in Arizona, huge demand for information, and a lot of farmers have already secured the license from the Department of Agriculture, and they started planting around the state this year. So we have a lot of fields. I'm not sure with the acreage right now, Bill, but I would guess we have probably several thousand acres of hemp, industrial hemp, planted in the state this year. It's kind of an experiment on their part. They're taking a chance by putting crops in the field they've never grown before.
Well, I have no idea how that works. I mean, what's the season? What's the hemp growing season? I mean, I know roughly about our cotton season, and you know, what's hemp season? Is it year round or?
Well, it would be. It's a warm season crop.
Okay.
It'll be produced as an annual, and it is as other forms of that species are. They're an interesting plant because they're what we call a dioecious plant. They have male plants and female plants.
Mm.
And all of them, we mentioned cannabinoids, all of them carry this rich concentration of like over 500 cannabinoid compounds. And they're going to vary, and we're wondering about planting date varieties, how that will affect the various compounds, one of which is THC, which is the active ingredient in medicinal or recreational marijuana. And that can't be anything above 0.3%. Now, that's going to put some challenges in there analytically, but we're also asking, goes back to your basic question about planting date, variety, basic agronomics, basic crop and soil management issues. We don't know, to be honest with you. We're going to have to find out through experimentation and also through probably trial and error with the farmers that are out in the field. But this is a classic example where we need to be at a land-grant university in terms of working with industry to try to
bring... You
need
to be the leader here.
Yeah, we need to be out front. Honestly, to be honest with you, we had to wait to get the licensing and get approval through the attorneys. And because there was a problem at the beginning with the Department of Agriculture granting the Farm Bill, but the Department of Justice still looked at cannabis sativa, all of it is marijuana. And so we didn't want to get in trouble with the university with the feds.
That the U of A U Arizona was in the marijuana.
Yeah, we didn't want to get that started. So we wanted to do it right, do it legal. That took a little while, but as a result, we're a little behind the curve, but we're trying to catch up. But we have good people in the field and working with our growers, and that's how we try to get started.
All right, we'll talk more about this with Dr. Jeff Silvertooth, the Buckmaster contributor on agriculture. If folks have any questions or comments, Jeff would be happy to entertain those. Our live line number is 790-2040. It's 1030 The Voice, trusted news talk in Southern Arizona. We'll be right back.
Vero Amore is Tucson's only certified authentic Neapolitan wood-fired pizza, where every flavorful pizza, pasta, panini, and salad is homemade using the finest local and imported ingredients. Vero Amore, Plaza Palomino and on Dove Mountain Boulevard in Marana, plus a full catering menu and mobile pizza truck for parties and events. Vero Amore on the web at veroamore.com. The Regional Transportation Authority's 20-year transportation plan is funded through June 2026 by a special taxing district, which is a state-established political subdivision within Pima County. The RTA plan and half-cent excise tax were voter-approved in May 2006, and the tax is collected within the district. More about RTA Citizens Advisory Committee's efforts to develop an RTA continuation plan at rtamobility.com. Buckmaster Show listeners know about my love of travel and flying from Tucson International Airport. I know you value your time and money, so it makes sense to fly Tucson with nearly 60 daily nonstop flights to major hub airports. If you're flying to another airport to take a nonstop flight, you're still making a connection and spending 4 hours on the road traveling to that other airport. That's why I fly Tucson and encourage you to do the same.
The Friends of Pima Animal Care Center is the nonprofit partner to our Pima County Animal Shelter. We grant critically needed resources to PACC so that it can continue the amazing life-saving progress it has made in recent years. Your generosity helps us find homes for abused, neglected, and abandoned animals at PAC. Learn how you can help at friendsofpacc.org.
Let's say you need an honest roofer. Where do you start? Better Business Bureau of Southern Arizona has more than 3,200 accredited businesses ready to help and committed to doing things right. Next time you need a trusted mechanic, plumber, AC company, or florist, go to our website, bbb.org, or call us at 520-888-6161. Better Business Bureau of Southern Arizona. We are here to help you find local companies you can trust.
At Sierra Tucson, we see miracles of healing every day. We are honored to be an international premier treatment center right here in Southern Arizona. Our comprehensive evidence-based programs focus on addiction recovery, mood and anxiety disorders, trauma recovery, including PTSD, pain recovery, and co-occurring disorders. Learn more at SierraTucson.com or call us at 800-842-4487. We work with most insurance payers.
Welcome back. It is the Buckmaster Show in the Green Thing Zocalo Village Studio. We're talking with Dr. Jeff Silvertooth. Jeff is the Buckmaster Contributor on Agriculture. He's such an accomplished man in the field of agriculture, professor at the University of Arizona College of Agriculture and Life Sciences since 1987, Associate Dean and Director for Extension and Economic Development. I remember from my days as an undergraduate at the U of H, Jeff, a million years ago, it just was the College of Agriculture. When was this life sciences tacked on?
That's a good question. Yeah, it was about, approximately, I would say about 2002.
And life
science? No, excuse me, 1992. Pardon me, 1992.
Yeah.
And it was added because, and legitimately, mm-hmm. and I'd say today, probably about 50% or more, 70% perhaps, of the college orientation is in life sciences, which means we have a lot of people in our college today that are basic scientists working at a biochemical instead of molecular level, and they work both plant systems and animal systems, but they're at the bench at the very molecular level of operation, which when we need that information on a basic science level to be able to translate that and apply it into the crop production systems that we have, the plant production systems we work with. But probably about 60-70% of our personnel, faculty, staff, and our programs are oriented towards that level of science. So it's similar to what you see in a college of science or even a college of medicine. It's just different orientation or applications. And that's where the life sciences name was expanded. It's been said that about 80% of our college is environmental science and life science, with about 20%, maybe 25% more oriented towards the traditional areas of agriculture, family, consumer health sciences, 4-H, which is what we do in extension. Interesting. Mm-hmm. We're the applied arm and the translational science arm of the College of Agriculture Life Sciences, or our division now, which includes veterinary medicine, which was just recently sanctioned and approved. So they're building a new vet medicine school at the U of A as we speak.
And climate change is big too.
Yes, sir. Yeah, absolutely.
That's part of your portfolio.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Absolutely. There's quite a few entities on campus that are interested working on that, but certainly within agriculture, not just in terms of, you know, we have folks like Paul Brown, who's a biometeorologist, has been collecting weather data over 30 locations across the state for over 30 years. So we have an excellent record of meteorological information, and as it relates relates to many locations across the state and as it relates to many of our crop production systems. So he can document very clearly what's been happening in terms of temperature trends and changes across the state. And that's valuable to us in the long term as well as short term management. But we have a lot of people working at Climate Science, Mike Crimmins, Jeremy Weiss, Greg Garfin. We have quite a few people that are focusing on climate science and particularly how it relates to our production systems and how we deal with it. And growers and ranchers are very well aware of it. We're adapting as we go, like we do in a lot of other places.
One of your climate scientists is a regular on our program, Dr. Zach Guido.
Oh, sure.
He's part of your program over there, a UA climate scientist. In fact, he was just on the program on Tuesday, I believe.
So there you go.
So
yeah, he and Mike Crimmins do a nice podcast.
So we're going heavy this week, Jeff, with the Arizona College of Agriculture and Life Sciences. Before we get back to hemp, you brought up the vet school, and I do want to find out what the latest is on that. When we think of vet schools for veterinary medicine, we think of Fort Collins has been kind of the leader in the West, right?
And that and UC Davis.
And UC Davis are kind of the two Western vet schools. So now are we going to get in the game here or what?
We are, yes. Yes, so this is brand new to the University of Arizona. It was conceived about 7-8 years ago. I guess it's, people have been talking about it a long time, but it began to really get some traction about 7-8 years ago and has come to fruition through a long, tortuous process of building, reviews, and of course has to be accredited. That's when you really have a legal veterinary medicine program, like a lot of other professional schools. They have to be accredited, to be accredited by a board of professionals working in that arena. And we just recently, the university and our division just recently received accreditation. So the university has hired a dean for this new vet school, and she has hired several associate deans, and they're building up a staff. They're building their programs. The curriculum, of course, had to be provided for accreditation. You know, what are you going to do? How are you going to do it? And demonstrate quality in the program. So the accreditation just was recently received, a letter of accreditation. So UVA Veterinary Medicine Program will be accepting students and for their first class in August of 2020.
Really?
Yes, sir.
This school going to be?
Well, it's in several buildings on campus, and they have their primary location at the Oral Valley location up in the North Oracle. But they're going to be utilizing labs and facilities on several other existing buildings. So it's not a new building being built on campus, but they're being incorporated in for what was the College of Agriculture, Life Sciences, and we call it a division now because it includes the Division of Agriculture, Life, Veterinary Sciences, and Cooperative Extension. So it has this several pillars associated with the division. But the thing that really changed us over from being simply a College of Agriculture, Life Sciences was the addition of the Vet Medicine Program and operating under the common umbrella administratively within the university. So we have one vice president, Vice President Burgess, that's in charge of that division, which includes basically the College of Ag, Life Sciences, Cooperative Extension, Vet Medicine right now.
Do you know, is that a good field to go into for young people?
Well, that's an interesting question. I'm not a veterinarian.
Just wondering if you know, we all hear about nursing shortages and certainly a physician shortage in rural areas of Arizona. I don't know anything about whether there's a shortage of vets.
I think where there's a shortage of vets, because we have an abundance of veterinarians that are in the small animal business.
Yeah.
And that's where most of them want to go.
Dogs and cats.
That's where most of the business is.
What about cattle and horses?
Well, that is the limitation. And there's the big, that was one of the major driving forces to get this school built, was from the animal science industry saying, we need veterinarians out in the state. And just kind of in rural areas need physicians.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they need veterinarians out in the state. And we also would like to be able to retain Arizonans that go to vet school. They go to way, like you mentioned, Colorado State, UC Davis, Washington State, excellent vet schools in the West, but they attend those vet schools and they have a tendency to stay away.
Sure.
And so there's an interest in trying to keep Arizonans that become veterinarians, keep them in Arizona. So those are two real things. And the other thing too, they were trying to develop this program so a veterinarian could be educated and trained more economically and not have to spend so much and end up carrying such a debt when they finish vet school and then go into a job that maybe doesn't pay them as much.
Yeah, they could be like, we commonly hear about that on our show that we run that runs after this program on the Dave Ramsey Show, which airs here on 10:30. We air that at 1 o'clock after the Buckmaster Show. And Dave keeps hammering, Jeff, on this student debt thing. You got some doctors, and I don't know, I'm sure it probably translates the same as kind of doctors and dentists and vets hundreds, Jeff, of thousands of dollars in debt to start their careers.
Yes, sir. It's a real issue in our society today. But, you know, let's be honest about it. Universities have increased their tuition rates. I mean, it's up to about, it's just shy of $13,000 a year for an in-state resident student for registration and tuition fees at the, full-time at the U of A.
Wow.
And so the difference has taken place because legislators and the public has decided that this isn't something we want to subsidize.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're going to still maintain, the costs are still there. So what the costs have been, instead of being subsidized by the state taxpayers, it's being passed on to the consumer.
Yes.
And that's essentially where we are, not just in Arizona, but in a lot of states across the country. It's been a national trend. But that's an interesting question about our education systems today and how we afford to do it.
All right. Only about a minute left with Jeff Silvertooth, so I'll circle back just briefly to our lead topic with Jeff about Arizona and 12 other states recently legalizing the growing of hemp. This would be an ongoing story, and if marijuana becomes recreationally legal in Arizona, that could be the next frontier, Jeff, for you and your colleagues to look into. Not the next frontier for you to go into the business, but you're gonna have to know all about marijuana growing.
That's right.
Perhaps.
That's right.
And more than likely.
I would see it as maybe not inevitable, but very likely.
Very likely.
High probability.
So you're gonna have to learn all about that now.
Yeah, this lesson with industrial hemp has been informative as to what this will be involved. But the good thing is they are the same species, and there will be differences with varieties and selection types. Just like with peppers, there's what's over 40 some different pod types with one capsicum annuum, you know, one pepper genus and species. So we're going to be dealing with that very likely in the near future, and it's going to be an interesting challenge. But I think the industrial hemp is giving us a lead, at least in dealing with that genus and species, and begin to the process of going through that regulatory transition.
Yeah, it gives you a bit of a head start.
Yes, sir.
Jeff Silvertooth, always a pleasure. I look forward to our next visit.
Likewise, Bill. Thank you very much.
On behalf of Jeff Silvertooth and my fine engineer producer, Ray Allen, I'm Bill Buckmaster. Thanks for joining us on 1030, Tucson's most trusted news talk source. See you tomorrow with our Friday Focus interview.